America, and of all our listeners all over the world, you're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host for the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me as always is Chris Elogi. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah. This episode is going to be for February 24th, 2024. Is it going to be? I don't think it's going to be the last show of the month. I think we still got one more for next week, but
no, it'll be on the 2nd.
Oh, it will? March 2nd. All right, then. Yeah, because it's February. It's the shortest month of the year. last show for the month. We'll be talking to you in March next time you hear from us. And yeah, so what have we got for this week? Well, amongst some other things, just a bunch of really stupid political shit. The Supreme Court of Alabama decided that frozen embryos can be considered children, which basically means that now the state legislatures are basically working overtime to try and create a bill to protect IVF treatment. But we'll be getting to all of that, of course. There was also a very just awful story that came out of Oklahoma that just gets worse and worse the longer it goes on. We've also got some stuff from the FDA. We got news from the Guinness World Records over a controversy over one of their oldest dog ever records. We got some science news, including the fastest growing black hole ever recorded. And we've also got a bunch of entertainment related news, including a bunch of trailers, one for a, I guess, kind of popular gaming franchise, and another based on a very anticipated Alex Garland feature that I personally have been anticipating. And of course, we got some Netflix stuff as well. But anyway, we got all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So to start us off, as always, as is tradition, Chris, start us off here. Top us off. What are we doing? What have you been doing this week?
Working a lot.
Yeah.
We had some warmer days in like the upper 40s, low to mid 50s. Mm-hmm. So that was nice. And then today it's like, hey, what if it's a high of 32 and it's and chill in the teens again?
Mm-hmm.
With a little bit of snow overnight as well. That,
yeah.
Just remind you that it's still Ohio and still winter. So That's been fun. Not really doing a ton. Didn't really watch much this week. It wasn't just watching stuff. For other things I've been doing, I've been playing Final Fantasy VII Remake again.
Mm-hmm.
Beat it, finally.
Mm-hmm.
I did have the game crash in the final two boss fights,
mm-hmm.
Which is all one whole sequence, so it does not save like a checkpoint or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go redo that all again. That was annoying. They go incredibly heavy-handed on the, is our fate determined already, or are we able to make new things happen and all that, complete with, thrown up versions of old cutscenes from the original game kind of thing in there. So that was fun. And I started up Intermission, or Intergrade, whatever that's called. The Yuffie little campaign there.
Yep.
So that's pretty fun so far. Though her combat's a little bit different. The first hard fight you get with some dogs, I got fucking worked. Died to them a few times before I really got it. I also had like half the health I should have had. So that didn't help when I was able to get hit a couple times and already be in need of healing and not able to get that, but I figured it out. Got to the point where you catch up with Avalanche, but not the main crew of Avalanche, though you're in and around where they're at this point in the story, I think. This is where they're kind of hanging out in the one town where Cloud's got the apartments, where he's the most boring person in the world. Because the Marl is the basically tells Yuffie that straight to face, like, man, if you're really interested in this guy, he's completely emotionally unavailable. has built a wall around him that he himself cannot see around. Talks absolute shit about him. Then they introduce new minigames.
Mm-hmm.
One that's like a mobile game, like Clash of Clans kind of style thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm trying not to get invested in because it's not hard for one, at least where I'm at. But it's nice seeing some people again, like the guy that you do the first big motorcycle fight with.
Mm-hmm.
He's there and he's like become infatuated with Cloud, I guess, after getting worked by him.
Mm-hmm.
In that, so, but he also has the whole thing with the little mini game thing. So he's almost like, no, you can't pick on me yet until you beat enough people, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they determine that stuff, but that's been pretty fun. It seems like it's two chapters, so probably not too long
mm-hmm.
for that. So I'll probably get that beaten here in the next few days.
But, mm-hmm.
That's been the big thing I've been doing. The other thing, Army of Ruin. Mm-hmm. Been playing some more of that as I complete various challenges, which they tie to that stuff in a lot of the trophies. So nothing really too much going on there
mm-hmm.
For that. And then been playing a bunch of American Truck Simulator as I finished up one of the challenges
mm-hmm.
in that game. The events they were doing for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
That they had you had to deliver 14 trailers of Valentine's gifts to various places. So I did that in American Truck Simulator versus Euro Truck Simulator. And by the end, I had enough money that I bought myself a new truck in there. Like from Freightliner, which has fancy new screens in it, like probably what modern trucks have these days versus what they probably were like 10, 15 years ago. So I'm hoping that's going to be a nice, fun time. And it wasn't too expensive for, I had probably about $600,000 and that was maybe like $230,000 to get that. So, looking forward to driving with that, but that's been pretty much all I've been doing. So Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as for me, I started playing the new Splatoon 3 DLC, which is Side Order. It's more or less it's more or less like a spiritual successor to the Octo expansion that they had with Splatoon 2, down to the fact that you're literally playing the same character. But basically, what happens is once you get the DLC download and everything, you get the announcement that the railway between Splat Town, where Splatoon 3 is largely located at, and Inkopolis, where Splatoon 2 is mostly located, has been redone, so you can go there if you want. And what happens is you end up falling asleep on the train, and you end up getting like enveloped in like code or whatever. And you suddenly find yourself in this vaguely virtual reality version of Inkopolis where all of the color has basically gone. It's all like whites and grays and stuff like that with like these weird sort of AI looking things walking around. And you end up getting met by Pearl from Off the Hook, except she's this weird little drone thing. And she basically more or less cajoles you to go into the tower at the center of Inkopolis, where you are then greeted by Oct, who's Splatoon fans know, Oct is the real name of Deadfish, one of the music makers in that particular universe, who is basically guarding this elevator. And the goal is you have to go up a few floors and eventually free Marina, the other half of Off the Hook, because, it's Off the Hook. You can't have Pearl without Marina and vice versa. And plus, let's be completely honest, Marina is probably the most popular character of Splatoon, period. But then she basically reveals is that the place you're in is called the Miiverse, and it's essentially a virtual reality project that Marina had been working on where she was slowly sort of building a simulation of Inkopolis. And while she was doing it, there was this AI inside of it that calls itself the Order that started to more or less become sentient and started to slowly take over it, and eventually ends up attaching her to this machine that you end up freeing from her when you go up against her in the boss fight. And is now trying to use it to sort of leak out into the rest of the Splatoon world. Now, knowing that this is Splatoon, there's probably a lot more of this that's happening with the universe, because the thing about the Splatoon universe is, as you know, goofy and wacky as it looks on the surface, there's some pretty dark shit that's going on underneath the surface. It is the apocalypse, post-apocalypse, after all. And yeah, it's the actual game itself is more or less a roguelite. Every time you go into the tower, you are, I can't remember how many floors it is total that you have to go up. I think it's something like 20 or 30 floors. And every time you go, you are, much like with Octo Expansion, where you had the tests, you can basically choose like what type of level you want to go into. Do you want to do like a you know, destroy the portals level, or, you know, move the eight ball to the area level, or guard an area type thing, moving the goalposts, whatever, that type of thing. And when you do this, one of the things it does is it gives you something called a color chip. When you go into the tower, you're equipped with something called a color palette. And all of these chips that you get, they end up adding, you know, new effects onto your character. So like some chips will increase the amount of, you know, the area of splatter that your ink, you know, your ink weapon uses. Some of it will reduce the amount of ink you end up consuming. Some of it will like give you more armor that you can use, stuff like that, fairly, you know. And every time you end up dying, because the game is definitely not easy, you end up going back, starting again, you know, and all of the chips that you've built up, they end up getting converted into what are called me points, which you can then use to give to Marina, who will then hack the simulation for you in order to, like, you know, increase the amount of life you've got, you know, increase the power of your weapons, make certain items appear more frequently and make it easier, you know, stuff like that. So the longer you go on, the stronger you get. And that's pretty much where I'm at. I have not been able to beat the first boss yet. And the bosses are like all like much like the actual levels, the bosses are also random, more or less. They can be anything from like this like enormous like ball thing that rolls around shooting ink. There's one where it's like it's sort of like the Octo Expansion one, where you're fighting against, you know, Octoling clones, stuff like that. But yeah, that's Splatoon 3 Side Order. Actually, really good. I actually really recommend it. And also reminded me, I still have not finished the main campaign for Splatoon 3 yet. So, but yeah. On top of that, I'm also still playing Persona 3 Reload, which is a, you know, and I'm actually almost finished with it. Like, I'm almost to, like, we just had, like, a major character death. There was a lot of, you know, hemming and hawing. This sense that we're fixing to go up against something huge. So yeah, I'm almost done with it, and I've actually started writing my review. And hopefully it'll be finished before the end of next week. But that, I've also, just the other old stuff, you know, J-pop, still love J-pop, still listening to a bunch of it, exploring it, enjoying it. And really the only other thing is, you know, job hunting, you know, because since I got laid off, I've got to, you know, find another place to work at. You know, I got opportunities, and I'm in a better position now than I was, you know, before I started my last job. So, you know, that's good. But yeah, that's pretty much everything I've been doing. So you want to move? You want to add anything before we move on, Chris?
Nope.
All right. All righty then. Well then, for everybody, it's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And Chris, I want to ask you, do you like sushi?
I haven't had enough of it to really know, but I had some. Wasn't a huge fan of it.
I can understand that. Sushi is one of those foods where, you know, the quality, that effort that's put into it really makes the difference. You know,
also kind of just trying to try something out is not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
When you're not sure, like, what would be good?
Yeah. Yeah, especially with sushi because, you know, you're talking about all kinds of different seafood and you got to think like, you know, what fish is specifically, you know, good enough for what it is I'm looking for, you know, because some fish are more watery than others. Some are a bit tougher, you know, stuff like that. And with sushi in general, you know, like I said, effort is also a massive part of it. Like, you know, there is a like huge difference between like, you know, sushi made by like an actual sushi master and like, you know, gas station sushi. You know what I mean? You could definitely tell the difference between the two. One is incredibly flat, fresh, handmade. The other is, you know, loaded with preservatives and may or may not kill you, or give you some mother of all diarrheas. But so yeah, sushi. We all have this idea of what sushi is when we think in our heads. It's either, you know, the classic, which is, you know, rolled up in the nori weed, you know, in rolls, or the nigiri style where, you know, it's, you know, piece of fish on a flat piece of rice, you know, served that like that. And that's what we think is sushi. And for a long time when sushi was like this thing that was first being promoted in the U.S., they had this huge thing about trying to promote sushi as being this big part of Japanese tradition. It's a tradition. It goes back hundreds of years, and over the centuries, the Japanese have perfected the art of.
And also, a lot of the sushi that we have is like actually sashimi.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because the thing with sushi is the name doesn't refer to the stuff that's on top. It refers to the rice specifically.
Yeah.
And like a lot of like sushi rolls we eat here, you know, were actually invented here in North America. Like the California roll, for example, that was invented up in Canada. Yeah. You know, the thing about sushi is I talked about it, it's like, yeah, it was hundreds of years, and over the centuries, the Japanese have perfected the art of, you know, the freshest raw seafood on the most perfect of rice. They're only half right though, because sushi as we know it is actually a very recent invention in the way that we look at it. So like what I just talked about as we envision sushi, you know, the rolls, the stuff on the rice, the, you know, wrapped in the nori weed and all that stuff. That stuff is only about as old as like the 19th century. It's actually a very recent invention, and it was largely like, it wasn't like a luxury thing either. It was like put out in like, you know, food carts and you know, and vendors and stuff at like, you know, on street corners and theaters and stuff like that, you know. Not terribly, not something you would consider a luxury item. It was very much a working class type thing. And they could get away with it because Japan, you know, is famous for having, you know, incredibly fresh seafood and very high standards about that seafood. But sushi has existed for a long time, just not in that fashion. Sushi, as we know it, as it originally came into existence, was originally called narzushi. That's narezushi. And it was not actually made as like a concession stand type thing or something that you bought on a street corner. It was actually something that was used to preserve the fish. And this is one of those things where it's like, if you've ever heard me talk about stuff like garum or fish sauce or something like this, some of this will sound as vaguely familiar to you. So the idea was back in the day, you know, you had to find some ways to preserve your food because you didn't have refrigeration or anything like that. So you had like a couple options. You could, you know, cover it in salt or, you know, cure it, smoke it, that type of thing. Or you could ferment it. And with Narazushi, they took the fermentation option. So what they would do was they would take a jar and they would fill it with a bunch of raw fish. They would cover it in salt, and then they would cover it in a layer of rice. Then they would then add rice vinegar into the mixture, and that would be one layer. And then they would add some more fish, and they would do the whole thing over and over again until, you know, the jar was full. And they did it until it was what was called as onare, or fully fermented. And the where they actually got this idea is actually not original to Japan. It was originally from Southeast Asia. In and around, it's believed that it came from around the Mekong River Basin. So, you know, where like Laos and Cambodia and Thailand are, or somewhere near like Myanmar. There's there's an entry in a dictionary from China from the 4th century that sounds vaguely like something that would be similar to Narazushi. And it actually, if you look at that area, you'll find like a bunch of all of these cultures had some way of like fermenting fish. You know, you had like tinapayan in the Philippines, you had peklasam in Indonesia, plara in Thailand, sikhae in Korea, stuff like that. So yeah, you put this and then you put it out into the sun and you just let it, you know, ferment for a while. And as it was happening, you know, the fish and all that stuff, it would reduce, the salt would permeate it, because, you know, the quote-unquote putrefaction that happens when it's fermenting gets absorbed by the salt and the good type of bacteria that you want when you're fermenting foods is able to thrive in that environment. Obviously, the vinegar helps. And as for the rice, well, the rice was mostly there as a way to help along the fermentation. Once the process was done with and they decide to open up the jars and start, you know, picking out the food, they would just sort of throw the rice aside because at this point it had become just a lumpy, sloppy, gross mixture that isn't terribly appetizing. So, yeah, for like centuries, that was basically what sushi was. It was that this type of it was this fermented fish thing where you would use, you know, the rice as a way to help along the fermentation, not something that you'd actually eat. That all started to change in the early 19th century. See, when you're using a bunch of rice to help ferment something along and then throwing it away, if you think about it, that's kind of a waste of rice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about a staple crop like rice, where, you know, depending on how the harvest is, you know, it can be a life or death situation. You know, Japan was not unheard of for Japan's to suffer famines during its history because of a bad rice crop. And at some point in the 19th century, people started to just came up with this idea. So they're like, you know what? I like this idea of, you know, eating fish on top of this rice and everything, but why are we wasting all this rice? Why can't we just find some way to take this, you know, find this way to keep this rice so we can actually eat the rice and not just have to throw it away? Well, that all started to happen in the 1800s. What they decided to do is they had already had like the rice vinegar to use. They just decided, you know what? Instead of just, you know, using the rice to help this along when we soak it with the rice vinegar, let's just take this rice that we've already got, you know, soak it in the rice vinegar and then keep it there, keep the rice. And we'll take, you know, the seafood that we've got, we're just absolutely loaded with it. There's just tons of it around. And it is true. Japan is probably, of all the countries on Earth, one of the ones that is just gifted with the best seafood you can get. And just, you know, find ways to, you know, chop it up. Maybe we'll, you know, we can, like, put it in a bowl and, you know, which is what they call scattered sushi. Or we could do this thing where it's like, you know, we got all these little bits of fish and we can put them on these little pieces of rice. And we could just sell them to people, you know, while they're out in the street or, you know, when they're coming out of the theater, they just saw the new kabuki play and they're coming out and maybe they're hungry or for something. And that's what happened. Right around the 1820s or the 1830s, sushi as we know it today came into existence, called nigiri sushi or hand-pressed sushi. That's the one I was talking about where it's a piece of fish on top of a piece of rice. That's the one, that's more or less the birth of modern sushi. And to be completely honest, it's also the type of sushi I prefer because I've never particularly cared for the nori wrapping. I always found it as a little too chewy and honestly just kind of, I just don't like the texture, to be completely honest. But one common story of the origin is of a chef by the name of Hanaya Yohei, who lived from 1799 to 1858, who more or less perfected the technique of making hand-pressed sushi in Ryogoku. It was, however, slightly different still, because this type of sushi was, for one thing, the sushi rice, the little parsnip, was actually three times the size of what we typically get when you get sushi today. It was also half the amount of vinegar that was used. There was also more salt involved instead of sugar, because a lot of modern sushi tends to sort of cut the salt with little bits of sugar to give a bit of an additional sweetness to it. And also, you know, the idea of like serving seafood over rice wasn't unusual either. Like, eel balls, you know, unagi, you know, that was a pretty common way of eating seafood back then. And that's literally just, you know, eel on a bowl. But eventually this guy's work, it caught on and he started getting imitators, and those imitators got imitators. And then eventually by the turn of the 20th century, sushi as we know it had fully come into form. And of course you'd get later innovations like the conveyor belt sushi restaurants, the introduction of sushi into the Western world, wherein you would get stuff like the California roll and uramaki or stuff like that. But yeah, that's more or less the origins of sushi. It was a very different thing from what we originally think of as sushi until very recently. But yeah, and that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. So yeah, with that out of the way, it is now time for the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we have to start off with our assholes of the week. And our first asshole of the week is the Supreme Court of Alabama, which ruled that, for whatever reason, frozen embryos, which I'm pretty sure are not even fertilized yet, can be considered children under state law.
Yeah, this is tied to, an pair of wrongful death cases brought by three couples mm-hmm. who had frozen embryos destroyed in an accident at a fertility clinic.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos can be considered children under state law, and I guess would allow this to continue
mm-hmm.
versus having to change to something else.
Ruled
that an 1872 law, a state law allowing parents to sue over the death of a minor child,
mm-hmm.
applies to all unborn children regardless of their location. Also saying, Justice J. Mitchell wrote in the majority's ruling, unborn children are children without exception based on developmental stage, physical location, or any other ancillary characteristics.
Mm.
This is an all-Republican court, too.
Mm-hmm.
In case you need to know the state of Alabama's Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
He also said the court had previously ruled that fetuses killed while a woman is pregnant are covered under Alabama's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and nothing excludes extrauterine children from the act's coverage. Which is a hell of a term there, extrauterine children. The ruling brought a rush of warnings about the potential impact of fertility treatments
mm-hmm.
and the freezing of embryos, which had previously been considered property by the courts.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the ruling is stating that a fertilized egg, which is a clump of cells, is now a person. It really puts into question the practice of IVF. This is a CEO of Resolve, the National Infertility Association.
Mm-hmm.
The group also calling the decision a terrifying development for the 1 in 6 people impacted infertility, who need in vitro fertilization. And yeah, this has caused a lot of concern, both in the state as a number of clinics and hospitals have immediately stopped IVF treatments and other such stuff going on to wait to see how the legal stuff is going to fall on this.
And because of that, in the meantime, a bunch of state senators are basically working overtime to try to get a bill that will protect IVF treatment, because now these guys have basically created a legal firestorm. So,
Even getting the governor involved in this, as well as Republican state senators, which you also have to give a side eye to, is like, how are they going to twist this into their culture war shit?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, they're working on something. Who knows? I think Democrats have been like, "Yo, we've already put up bills for this and got shot down because we saw this kind of stuff potentially happening in the wake of Roe v. Wade getting overturned." And it's creating a huge issue for Republicans at the moment. As what was it, Tommy Tuberville, having a weird ass response, talking to somebody on CNN or whatever it was, basically being like, you know, I fully support this and all that, you know, we need more children and all that. And then the interviewer is like, but in vitro fertilization helps more children get born. And then he's caught in a loop there of trying to figure out how to talk his way out of this dumb viewpoints, contrarian viewpoint on all this. And it's like, yeah, this is the problem with everything. So these kind of idiots that are in charge of this stuff. But yeah, you know, things are fucked when the Senate GOP is like telling people, no, we need to actually support IVF because we're going to fucking get destroyed if we add that onto the abortion stuff. Yeah, this is what he said here. Reporter, do you have a reaction to the Alabama Supreme Court ruling? He said, I was all for it. We need to have more kids. And she says, but IVF is used to have more children and IVF services are paused at some clinics. And then his mind falls apart as he tries to somehow square the essentially the Christian nationalist viewpoint of this stuff. So,
yeah.
They do absolutely want to get to the point where they can outlaw IVF and contraception and all that.
Yeah.
But they're definitely going to have a hell of a fight trying to legally get their way there. But yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So yeah. And then this story is just, oh God, it's awful. It is just, it's awful and it's gross and it's infuriating in just all the way. So there was a teen in Oklahoma who identified as non-binary, they had they them pronouns, named Nex Benedict, and they were bullied for I'm guessing for a while, and the story I've been hearing is that eventually they just might have just finally decided to stand up for themselves, and they poured water on one of the bullies or something, and the bullies responded by beating her, basically beating them basically to death, because they beat them so badly they ended up in I guess in a hospital, and they ended up dying from their injuries. It's just
and it
the story gets worse from there. It's like, you'll just tell them.
The police are saying that, let's see, preliminary information from the medical examiner's office said a complete autopsy was performed, indicated that the decedent did not die as a result of trauma, which seems like them covering their ass from being scrutinized for dealing with this versus what seems to actually have happened. But yeah, this kid, I believe the story I heard is that somebody else, maybe a friend, was getting bullied by these girls, and they decided to pour water on them to like get them to stop going after the other kid. Mm. And instead they went after Nex and beat them pretty bad. But the school did not call for an ambulance or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just recommended a visit to the ER.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it's not a coincidence that they died the next day
mm-hmm.
after this incident. It seems like the school trying to cover their ass, I guess. Weird, but apparently the fight at a certain point was broken up by students and a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
All students walked to the assistant principal's office and the nurse's office.
Mm-hmm.
After contacting parents and guardians and conducting health evaluations, the nurse suggested next be taken to a hospital for further care.
Mm.
They had a school resource officer go to the hospital where next was being examined and interviewed. Mm-hmm. Both them and their parents or guardians. Mm-hmm. I think next was the guardian was their biological grandmother. So
mm-hmm.
she's been doing some interviews in the wake of this.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't like a recent thing for this school. This school was targeted by libs of TikTok.
Yep.
Because a teacher was teaching sex ed or doing something that was, seen as pro LGBT,
mm-hmm.
aka as they would call it, grooming.
Yeah.
Harassed the teacher enough that they resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And then the governor, 2022, I believe, instituted a bathroom bill that forced, requiring all pre-K to 12 schools to require students use the restroom and locker rooms of the sex designated on their birth certificates.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, Governor Kevin Stitt issued an executive order requiring government agencies to identify people according to their sex at birth rather than their gender identity. Essentially, that kind of stuff
mm-hmm.
essentially just legalizes harassment and all that kind of stuff
mm-hmm.
as far as kids are seeing. And it was also said that a number of these other girls and other people doing bullying at this school mm-hmm. Watch Libs of TikTok a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially regurgitate a lot of the shit that she says.
Mm-hmm.
And basically a lot of people are coming to the conclusion like, what's her name? Chaya Raychick, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
That she has blood on her hands in the
yeah.
in the wake of all this.
Yeah. Yeah, and they had someone interviewed her recently and she is dumb as shit.
Yeah.
Like legitimately, she is a very dumb, vapid human being.
She just knows the culture war talking points.
Yeah.
And does not know how to cultivate that into an argument.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a little bits of the thing that Taylor Lorenz had with her.
Mm-hmm.
And literally somebody cutting a clip that just is mm-hmm. hilarious out of context as Taylor's talking to her about a question. And Chaya just pulls out her phone and is like, look, here's a blowjob.
Mm-hmm.
And the context is that she's trying to pull out something from a sex ed book.
Mm-hmm.
And Taylor's just like, yeah, I did sex ed. That's a thing they show sometimes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And move on. She's just constantly trying to do this gotcha shit.
Yeah.
Never really has a point.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all she's doing is fighting the culture war.
Yeah. And then, last but not least, we have Bill Lee, the governor of Tennessee, signing a law that allows people to refuse to, quote, solemnize a marriage licenses for reasons you can probably guess.
Yeah, this is definitely something that's going to lead to the point where they can just start outright refusing gay marriages.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, at least this with allowing people to refuse to solemnize or perform a marriage if they disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
Is not the be all end all, but it's the slippery slope that this stuff can lead to.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there will be people that will be willing to perform those.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they are allowing for the religious folk that work in the government and whatnot to refuse to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's... it's not as egregious as some of this other stuff, but definitely is. I was like, keep an eye on this shit. Because we've seen where everything else has gone. So, yeah, that's probably going to lead to some shit later on.
Yeah, probably. This is the type of, you know, frog in a pot type thing where it's like, eh, it's not so bad. And then it just slowly boils and you realize, oh, we are so screwed. But, yeah. But fortunately, it's not all bad because we do have a Hero of the Week. And that Hero of the Week is Food and Drug Administration because they have approved a drug that helps treat severe food allergies, including milk, eggs, and nuts.
Yeah.
Which is actually really good because, yeah, those types of allergies can be a real bitch, man.
Yeah. But that is probably more recent as people try to link peanut allergies to like a... crazy like health nut thing or whatever. And it's like,
no, peanut allergies are a real thing.
Yeah, people just didn't treat them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, oh, I just get weird when I eat peanuts or drink milk or whatever. And it's like, yeah, no, you're just, you know, lactose intolerant or whatever.
Yeah.
Or allergic to it or whatever. But yeah, this new drug, Xolair, was greenlit by the FDA on Friday to help reduce severe allergic reactions brought on by accidental exposure to certain foods. It's considered the first medication approved by the FDA that can help protect people against multiple food allergies.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have had specific drugs for specific allergies, but this one covers at least a few of these. So that's great. It simplifies it, makes it a bit cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
For that, it's designed to be taken repeatedly every few weeks to help reduce the risk of reactions over times.
Mm.
Over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the FDA said people taking the drug should continue to avoid foods they are allergic to. It's not like some of the dairy supplement stuff that can help you eat things without, you know, always having to go to the restroom immediately after. But yeah, as they say, while it would not eliminate food allergies or allow patients to consume food allergens freely, its repeated use will help reduce the health impact if the accidental exposure occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
But it's still not super cheap. The cost of the medication ranges from $2,900 a month for children and $5,000 a month for adults. The cost could be brought down with insurance. So.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully that's the case. Otherwise, you know how insurance is.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh, fuck this. You pay full price.
Yeah. But, yeah. So, yeah, with that, we're moving from the show proper to the proper show proper. And our first story for the night is, well, for those, and this is kind of a bit, needs a bit of explaining. So remember all that stuff that was going on about how they were trying to impeach President Biden over these, I can't remember what it was about. It was about, like, you know, supposedly he was involved in some sort of corruption in Ukraine and all this stuff. Well, turns out that the guy who was the source for all this basically admitted to the FBI that he was lying through his teeth. And not only that, but that he was also basically using stuff that was tied with Russian intelligence. So,
yeah, it's this thing we talked about last week where he was charged with making false statements.
Mm-hmm.
But now through their sort of interviewing with him, and all that, has admitted to authorities that after he was arrested, that officials associated with Russian intelligence were involved in passing a story about President Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, has that he has extensive contacts with Russian intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was arrested last week, charged with making false statements and creating a false and fictitious record. And so, yeah, he's been in federal courts. So much so that, let's see, the magistrate judge heard arguments from both sides and then ordered that, what's his name here, Alexander Smirnov, be released on a personal recognizance bond, which went against the government's wishes, which asked the court to keep him in custody
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, in their detention memo, prosecutors pointed to what they called four indisputable facts that favored detention.
Mm-hmm.
They said claims to have contacts with multiple foreign intelligence agencies and had planned to leave the U.S. for months just 2 days after he was arrested to meet with Russian intelligence officials.
Mm-hmm.
They also argued that his foreign intelligence contacts could resettle him if he were to flee the U.S. And so there was a story even after this one that the judge feared that his lawyers were actively trying to help him get out of the country
mm-hmm.
as a result of this. So, yeah, that's all fucked.
Mm.
But this is a guy that's helped inform a number of people in Congress on the GOP side of this stuff. And, yeah, was actively pushing, you know, Russian propaganda
mm-hmm.
With your James Comer and all that kind of, all those kind of people. So, yeah, fun times. They're certainly not going to acknowledge that stuff
mm-hmm.
and apologize for pushing that. So there you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we also have this other story here. So Guinness World Records obviously has its own issues to deal with, like, you know, helping to legitimize authoritarian regimes, but, you know, stuff like that. But recently they had some controversy over one of their more famous titles, which is the oldest dog ever. And they recently just posthumously stripped the dog Bobby of his oldest dog ever title.
Yeah. They say they conducted a review just to confirm this or not. And basically said that, yeah, following concerns raised by vets and other experts, both privately as well as within public commentary and the findings of investigations conducted by some media outlets, we felt important to open a review into Bobby's record. And yeah, let's see. And basically concluded, yeah, saying there's no conclusive evidence available right now to confirm that he is actually this old. So they've pulled the record
mm-hmm.
For the time being, unless something changes. So
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go. That probably goes back to the old record, who was an Australian cattle dog named Bluey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who died at 29 years and 5 months. And I'm sure the verification for that is even sketchier than for this dog.
Oh, most definitely. All right. Now we got this little bit of just news that's just kind of pathetic. Former President Donald Trump has recently launched his new business venture where he's trying to sell these $400 gaudy gold-colored sneakers.
Yeah. I think they're only making 1,000 of these.
Mm-hmm.
And they're exactly what you would think they would be. They're gold-colored. They have a big T on the side, and the sort of back part of it has a version of the American flag on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks as bad as you think it would.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll probably sell out because there are enough sneakerheads who would want something weird like this.
Mm-hmm.
Even at that price. So, yeah. Though Fox News, I saw a clip from them being like,
mm-hmm.
oh, is he, you know, are black people going to switch to him because of this? And it's like, no. There's a part of the culture with sneaker stuff that people might want this because it looks so dumb, or it's something they can actually get. But yeah, it's not something that's going to cause people to see the light. It's just something he can make money off of. And yeah, he calls these the Never Surrender High Top Sneaker. Yeah. Said of the crowd at SneakerCon Philadelphia, which I believe is run by Trumper, so that's why he was there for this, to show this off, saying that's the real deal. Holding up the Flaxen footwear, which features an American flag on the back and capital T on the side. And yeah, they even got a bunch of boos out of this. So yeah, it's one of those things. Just adds to the fucking weird campaign that he's running that is not getting as much, say, criticism as he should be. As you've seen, a lot of media isn't taking him seriously again. despite him doing a lot of the same kind of shit that if Biden were doing, there'd be constant op-eds calling for him to be impeached and removed from office for the 25th Amendment or whatever. But the media is again just being like, oh, that's Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? He just wants to get back in office and destroy democracy, as people at CPAC were saying to applause.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're at in that whole thing.
Yep.
Be so much easier if he just died soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From that, we're moving on to some science news. Scientists recently discovered the fastest growing black hole that has ever been recorded.
Yeah. The way they frame it here, that it's so large that it eats the equivalent of one sun per day.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, it's the black hole also has a mass that's 17 billion times larger than our sun.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists in Australia have found that. Which comes through the discovery of a distant quasar containing what scientists say is the fastest growing black hole ever recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it's a surprise it remained undetected until now, given what we know about many other less impressive black holes. So shaming these other black holes here.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it was hiding in plain sight. Researchers first detected the black hole using a telescope at the university's Siding Spring Observatory in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And then confirmed it's with the European Southern Observatory's very large telescope,
mm-hmm.
one of the largest telescopes in the world. Mm-hmm. Despite black holes not emitting any light, very large ones form bright objects called quasars.
Mm-hmm.
Located in the middle of galaxies, quasars are illuminated by all the matter that heats up as it gets pulled in.
Yeah.
And so, the quasar is now the brightest known object in the universe, shining 500 trillion times brighter than the sun, which is kind of wild to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Black holes are surrounded by an accretion disk, a swirling zone where material is first dragged in before being consumed.
Mm-hmm.
This black hole's accretion disk is 7 light years wide. Saying it looks like a gigantic magnetic storm cell with temperatures of 10,000 degrees Celsius, lightning everywhere and winds blowing so fast they would go around Earth in a second. So you don't have to worry about this one. It is located 12 billion light years away.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a wild thing to read about.
Mm-hmm. And we also have this. Scientists unveil a 240 million year old dragon fossil that's been found complete. And obviously we don't mean like a fire breathing dragon. It's just a term they use for large lizards.
Yeah. This is a 5 meter long reptile from the Triassic period in China.
Mm-hmm.
That was first identified in 2003, but after studying 5 newer specimens for 10 years, scientists are able to depict the entire creature, which is named Dinocephalosaurus orientalis.
Mm-hmm.
One fully articulated fossil, the last to come to light, offered a beautiful complete specimen from the tip of the nose right down to the tip of the tail.
Mm-hmm.
It's curled around in this sort of figure of eight, and it's very reminiscent of a Chinese dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty neat looking.
Mm.
Helped illuminate this mysterious creature, and an international team of researchers from Scotland, Germany, the US, and China published their findings in the journal Earth in Environmental Science Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Mm. It's pretty cool. They have an artist. Rendering of this marine creature.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. Newer fossils indicate the creature had 32 vertebrae,
mm-hmm.
creating an extremely long neck that likely helped it catch fish.
Mm-hmm.
Though scientists are still unsure of its precise function. That's kind of the weird thing with these fossil things is you see the skeleton, but you don't necessarily know what the muscles
mm-hmm.
were like and the stuff that doesn't, get preserved in rock like that.
Mm-hmm.
They did find fish are still preserved in the stomach region of one fossil. So that was pretty good at what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It had flippered limbs, reinforced the hypothesis that it was a marine dwelling sort of creature. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, you can read the article for a bit more. So,
yeah. And next up, this kind of sad news. Wendy Williams has been diagnosed with aphasia and dementia.
Yeah.
She has had some issues in the last few years of her show. Mm-hmm. Even during the pandemic, sort of people noticing that she was having issues remembering things and having some emotional problems and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. So that's caused a lot of people some concern, especially so there was a documentary that's conveniently releasing around this time mm-hmm. About this. But yeah, she had struggles with Graves' disease and lymphedema.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of that, she has confirmed in a press release that she has primary progressive aphasia mm-hmm. and frontotemporal dementia, which aphasia can affects your ability to talk and communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And the dementia is a disorder that impacts behavior and cognitive functions, mm-hmm. Which is what I believe Bruce Willis was diagnosed with last year.
Mm-hmm.
Or was revealed what the diagnosis was last year. So, yeah. Going to be a rough time for her and her family here
mm-hmm.
for the foreseeable future, but at least she's, you know, made enough money she can live comfortably there and not have to worry about bills, hopefully, mm-hmm. with all that. So, yeah. Yeah, Where Is Wendy Williams is the documentary that's, yeah, that aired on... or airing tonight and tomorrow on Lifetime.
Hmm.
I'm sure it'll be available elsewhere at some point. So, yeah, that's sad news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now we're getting into the trailers and stuff. First, we got an official trailer for Borderlands. This is the film adaptation of the Borderlands series. And I don't know.
It looks like one of these kind of action movies.
Yeah.
Maybe in the vein of Guardians of the Galaxy, or a bunch of people that wouldn't normally have this association together, just come together to form a team / family kind of thing of weirdos. And yeah, it seems like it's okay at best, but interesting cast. Kate Blanchett, Kevin Hart, Jack Black. Jamie Lee Curtis, Gina Gershon, yeah, some notable names, but seems like the movie just like probably decent fodder on a streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
But going to a theater, maybe not ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I do find it interesting they have essentially have Tiny Tina in there.
Mm.
You know, I don't necessarily think of her as she was in what, Borderlands 2?
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird to put her in a movie of the characters from the first one.
Yeah, not only that, but she's, you know, a fully grown adult, which she isn't until Borderlands 3. So,
yeah.
It's just odd.
Yeah, that's just like, she's very popular in the Borderlands game, so.
She is. That's I mean, she's definitely one of my personal favorites, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to work. I would like to be proven wrong. You know, but I don't know. But other than that, we got a new official trailer for Alex Garden's upcoming film, Civil War.
Which reveals that not only is California and Texas part of this alliance trying to secede from the U.S.
Yeah.
Florida's involved as well, which is not a surprise at all.
No. And yeah. Basically trying to show like what an actual modern civil war states would actually look like. Because in some ways with our last civil war, we were kind of lucky because like there was this actual like border between the two sides that you could point to. The vast majority of civil wars are not like that. Yeah. Most civil wars are very deeply like they're as ugly as like an intra-family dispute is. You know, everybody throws dirt, nobody comes out of it with clean hands, you know what I'm saying? And that's sort of more or less what Alex Garland seems to be going for here.
Yeah.
And yeah, looking It's A24. You know, they don't hold back when it comes to shit like this. So I expect that whatever we see, whatever you're going to see in this trailer, it's the actual movie is probably going to be even worse in parts. So, yeah.
I would think this kind of movie would do pretty well with the sort of like a handheld camera kind of viewpoint.
Yeah.
What was the movie I'm thinking of? But yeah, that kind of viewpoint versus like a fully produced normal movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, because, you know, if this were happening, there'd be shit tons of cell phone video and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a pretty neat thing, but maybe for the prop, you know, the purpose of a movie, like having that for an hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever would maybe not work out, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah, still unsure like what the causing incident of this is.
Yeah, they're actually keeping it pretty vague. Other than the fact that, you know, Ron Swanson is president, and I'll be honest, if Ron Swanson did become president, this is exactly what I would expect to happen. I'm legit kind of anticipating this movie. I'm sure it's going to be brutal to watch, but, you know, the concept's definitely got me. And Alex Garland pretty much doesn't miss when it comes to his movies. So,
That'll be out April 12th, so not too much longer.
Mm-hmm. We also got an official trailer for Netflix's Shirley. This is a biopic about the first Black congresswoman and her trailblazing running for president of the United States.
Yeah, Shirley Chisholm.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Regina King.
Mm-hmm.
Great actor, so that'll be cool to see. Bunch of names in this. Lance Reddick is in this.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of his last few movies here, so.
Yep.
That's cool. Lots of good actors in this. Terrence Howard.
Mm-hmm.
All that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Looking neat. Trying to see if they have a date for this. March 22nd. So that's a month away. So that'll be cool mm-hmm. to watch. Because, yeah, mm-hmm. it's a thing that doesn't seem unique now as far as like a black woman. But this is in 1972.
Yeah.
Her just being like, why not? Why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Look at all these idiot white people. What mm-hmm. about me?
Yeah. Yeah. And for those who are curious, she was in the Senate, she was in the House of Representatives from 1969 to 1983. So she was actually there for a while.
Yeah.
Mm. But yeah. And last but not least, we got an official trailer for Netflix's Irish Wish.
Yeah, this is a neat movie. It's Lindsay Lohan, kind of part of her comeback tour of sorts, doing a rom-com for Netflix, coming out March 15th. Basically, she finds the former love interest has gotten engaged to her best friend.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to the weddings in Ireland, so she goes there as a bridesmaid and kind of makes a spontaneous wish that she was the one marrying him, and finds her, I don't know, the trailer and descriptions kind of don't tell me either way if it just changes her into the person, or if she's inhabiting the best friend's body. I think it's she's taken the place of the best friend, but in the process kind of maybe figures out that this person is maybe not the one true love for her, kind of thing. And looks like it's had some fun and all that, especially the being in Ireland kind of thing. So yeah, nice to see her kind of as she's gotten her life back in order, kind of getting shots like this to do some cool stuff. So this looks like a fun one of those. So yeah, that'll be out in a few weeks.
So that's our show for this week, folks. I do believe we've got ourselves a show. Yep, we got a show. So I'd like to remind all of our listeners, if you got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of Unscripted Shenanigans at archive.org, Google Play, RSS, pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. If we're not on there yet, just wait a little while. As soon as we find out there's a new one, we will almost certainly sign up for it as soon as we possibly can. But we're going to go ahead and wind it down for now. Thank you once again, Chris, for joining us. If you liked what you have heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your coworkers, your casual acquaintances, and your mortal enemies, and everyone in between, because they may like or be indifferent to you, but they may end up just liking us. And isn't that a beat we can all dance to? I certainly think so. But yeah, so we're going to go ahead and wind it down here. Join us next week where we will be back in the month of March to be talking about all this crazy shit to you. And we'll see you then. Good night, everybody.